Welcome, everybody, to this afternoon session. I'm Jeff Childers, and I live here in Abilene, so I get to introduce myself. I'm Jeff Childers, and I live here in Abilene. I want to jump right into this session about vagabond spirituality. Hopefully, my technology will work pretty well. With a quick definition, the word Exodus means exit. Getting out of here. And that's what Israel was doing in the book of Exodus, right? I mean, they'd been in slavery for 400 years. They'd been oppressed for all this time. They were ready to get out of there. So they exited. They departed. This is it. This is what we've been waiting for. Freedom. Now, I don't know if you've ever had someone really build something up big that you're going to do, like maybe a place you're going to visit or something you're going to see, and they're telling you how great and wonderful it is, and then you work hard to get there, and then when you get there, it's a bit of a letdown. Like, my kids tell me this happens a lot traveling with me. Like, if we're in Europe or somewhere, and I'm saying, you know, there's this great place to visit. You're going to love it. There's like centuries of history there. There's all of this amazing stuff that you're going to want to see and enjoy. And then when we actually get there, my kids look a bit like this, you know, which is here we are at an actual exciting, you know, ruin in Ireland, and they can't muster up any more enthusiasm than this for the experience. And I think Israel had to be a bit like that once they exited Egypt. In fact, the biblical text makes it clear that they were. And here we are. We're out of bondage, right? We're ready for a new life, right? So what now? Do we have a country? No. Well, do we have houses to live in? No. Do we have land? Land we can farm? Land we can shepherd? No. So what do we have at all? Let me get this right. We used to be slaves. We were oppressed. We were in slavery. That was bad. And now basically we're like vagabonds with just the open road in front of us. Is that good? And they grumbled. They grumbled. When their backs were against the Red Sea, and Pharaoh's troops were bearing down, they grumbled. And when there were water shortages, they grumbled. And when there were food shortages, they grumbled. I love this passage in Exodus chapter 16, where they're hungry and they tell Moses, if only we'd stayed in Egypt. There we sat around pots of meat. And when you're used to something like that, you know, you're going to miss it, right? Sitting around pots of meat. There they are, out in the wilderness, no place to go. How are you supposed to keep smiling like that? Most of the basics that you want to be able to take for granted, like you've got a house and you've got security, you've got a clear picture of what's going to happen the rest of the day and maybe even what's going to happen tomorrow, all of that stuff is absent. You're vulnerable all the time. You're needy all the time. It sounds a bit like an experience that you'd want to forget. Now, some parts of it were really memorable. You know, the liberation, the whole exiting part from Egypt was pretty cool. And they would tell this story over and over again and remember this story about how God rescued them out of Egypt. That liberation part you'd want to celebrate. And eventually they get to the Promised Land, and that's pretty cool too. So they want to celebrate that. But what about all the in-between bits? What about the 40 years of wilderness wanderings part? Your children will be shepherds here for 40 years, suffering for your unfaithfulness. Not only was it homelessness, not only was it vagabondage, it was punishment. And you could understand why they'd want to forget about that. But instead, they kept that memory alive too. They told the stories over and over again. And they had festivals to keep the memory alive. Festivals of Passover, festivals of booths to remember what it was like to be homeless vagabonds for all of those years. And sometimes they even look back on that time and they remember it very, very fondly. Like in Jeremiah chapter 2, the Lord says, I remember the devotion of your youth, how as a bride you loved me and followed me through the desert. Or Hosea chapter 2, where the prophet talks about the wilderness wanderings as if they're like a honeymoon time where the Lord and His people are getting to know each other, they're getting close, they're learning about each other, and they're coming to cherish each other deeply. Psalm 103 reflects back on this story of the wilderness wanderings, but it doesn't remember it mostly as a time of punishment and judgment and hardship and homelessness. It remembers it mostly as a time when people learned how merciful God was and how compassionate God was and how forgiving the Lord is. Psalm 78 is a famous psalm that recites this story and includes these passages about the wilderness wanderings. And it pictures those journeys as a time when we discovered that God can spread a table in the desert, the psalmist says. They got to eat the bread of angels. They got to eat the grain of heaven. He led them like sheep through the desert. He guided them safely, the psalmist says. And then there's Isaiah 63. Looking back on those days of homelessness and remembering that those were times when the Lord seemed very present. His Holy Spirit was right there in the midst of them. That was a time when He led them so that like a horse in open country, they didn't stumble. And they were given rest by the Spirit of the Lord. For a lot of years, the children of Israel had no place to lay their head. But that wasn't all bad. In spiritual life, and in the life of a church, and I'm going to be bouncing back and forth between personal spiritual life and the congregational life of a church, a people like the children of Israel, times of dislocation and times of insecurity are sometimes the very best of times. That's true for individuals, and it's true for churches too. And so this wandering story gets told and retold until it settles down into the consciousness of the people. My father was a wandering Aramean, they'd say when they brought their first fruits offerings to the priests. And they were talking about Jacob, but they're also talking about Abraham before Jacob, who was a wandering Aramean. And they're also talking about the children of Israel in the wilderness. And they come to be talking about David, you know, on his way into his kingdom, and Jesus and his disciples traveling around Palestine, knocking about Galilee. And they're talking about the church, which is a pilgrim church, as Hebrews says. It doesn't really settle in a city here. It's looking for a city to come. In early Christianity, the name for the movement is the Way. It's a thing about journey. It's about moving. Well, there have been a lot of Christians over the years who have connected to this picture of a sort of vagabond spirituality. And Brady Bryce asked me to do this class on Exodus in the history of Christian spirituality, which is like a big topic. You know, we would be here for 40 days and 40 nights if I were to start going into all that. But I just want to scratch the surface a little bit and maybe find some images and some topics in this that can help us see the benefits of this identity as a people on the move. This identity as a people on a journey, wandering through the wilderness. Today we're going to focus on the journey, and then tomorrow morning we're going to talk about the spiritual benefits of wilderness living. In a revival kind of heritage like ours, we tend to think of salvation as a done deal. You know, it's like a package. It's a state that you're in, or it's a thing that you own. You're either saved or you're lost. You're in or you're out. You're holding your heaven ticket or not. And we sort of think about salvation that way, in these static terms. one of the problems with that static picture of what the Christian life is meant to be and what salvation is all about is that it struggles to deal with some things. It struggles to deal with things like, what about when you experience spiritual growth? What about when your nature, the nature of your relationship with the Lord changes? Does that mean it invalidates wherever you were before and whatever you were doing before? Or maybe if you were to change your mind about something, well, which is it? Are you wrong now, or were you wrong then? Or is there maybe some other way to look about it? What if things seem different lately in comparison to the way they've seemed before? Maybe they're harder. Maybe it's drier. Maybe it's a season of doubts. Maybe there are difficulties that you didn't experience yesterday or last year or 10 years ago. What does this mean? Does this mean, you know, you were in before but you're out now? Or do these kinds of things mean that we're on a kind of a journey? And I want to kind of underscore this different way of thinking about salvation, not as a static thing, not as a state or a possession, but as a process. We are being saved, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1. It's like this ongoing process. It's on the move. It's alive. We're going places. The book of Hebrews talks about us being on a race. That's a picture that it wants to grab. This is like a race, which is a sort of journey. And we're moving somewhere, and we're following somebody who's ahead of us in the race. We're keeping our eyes focused on Jesus Christ. Because, after all, God began a good work in us, and He's going to carry it on until it's completed. In Philippians chapter 1, but Paul goes on to say in chapter 3, not that I've already attained all this, but I'm pressing on. Pressing on, straining towards that end. This is something that's sort of on the move. It's changing, it's growing, it's dynamic, it's alive. 2 Peter chapter 1 talks about things being added to your abilities, to your capacities, to your virtues, to your Christ-likeness in increasing measure. It's kind of on the move. Stuff's happening. And as with any journey, you would expect that one day might be a little different than another day. Some seasons might feel differently than other seasons. And that doesn't mean you're bouncing in or out. It means you're on a journey. Like the children of Israel in Exodus. A lot of Christians have pictured the Christian life as a journey. For Benedict of Nursia, who lived in the 500s, the Christian life is a ladder. And the more you practice humility towards other people, not just think it or feel it, but actually practice it, the farther up the ladder you get, until you reach the lowliest one of all, the King of Heaven. For Teresa of Avila, who lived in the 1500s, the Christian life is like this mansion with many different rooms. And you're on this journey of moving deeper and deeper into the heart of this house, getting closer and closer to God who lives in the middle of it, becoming more and more like God as you go along. For the 5th century writer of the Book of Steps, the Christian life is this journey up a mountain. There's a pathway that has twists and turns and, yes, occasional missteps, but also along the way these great opportunities to grow and great opportunities to serve as you get higher and higher and closer to the Lord's dwelling place. The Irish are a little short on mountains and ladders and other things like this. They don't have a lot of deserts either, but they've got boats and a lot of ocean. So for the Irish in the early Middle Ages, it was a sea voyage. You're climbing into a little boat and you're casting off to wherever it is the Lord's going to take you out there on the highways of the ocean. In the life of Brendan, who's an early medieval Irish saint, one of the monks says, "Father, let's get into the boat and sail to the island called the Promised Land of the Saints." The Promised Land in a boat. Moses didn't sail towards the Promised Land. But it's the same journey in a way. You know, it's the journey of every Christian. It's the journey of every church. It is a journey. And just like Brendan's journey from Ireland, Israel's journey started at the water of the Red Sea. Now, Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10 that the Red Sea was like the Israelites' baptism. And there were lots of early Christian writers that loved to talk about this and talk about how the Israelites going through the Red Sea were experiencing a kind of baptism. And Christians being baptized are being taken through the walls of water in the Red Sea. Which it's interesting for me because in my heritage, you know, the baptistry is mostly full of these kind of static notions of salvation. But when your baptistry flows into the Red Sea, it's a pretty different kind of experience. It's not just a membership qualification. It's the beginning of a journey. It's not just a boundary marker that kind of determines who's in and who's out because you've done it or you've not done it. It's this gateway to adventure. I wish that, a lot of baptistries have pictures. And you can't really see this one very well because of the washout, but this is from a 5th century church in Rome, and it's the crossing of the Red Sea. And what a great image that would be, you know, in a baptistry. Or this great picture by Chagall, which shows the children of Israel going across the Red Sea, and the Spirit of God's there, and there are just a lot of cool images there. Baptism is the beginning of this vagabond lifestyle with the Lord. They even practiced it in their rituals. Early Christians, after you were baptized and you took the Lord's Supper for the first time, they'd give you milk and honey, which was a symbol of moving towards the promised land. So over the years, Israel's journey has inspired Christian spiritual writers with, you know, images like this. And I just want to share a few pearls of their wisdom for our time this afternoon. And as I do this, what I'd love for you to do is to use your imagination and think about ways that these pictures and these insights and these bits of wisdom from the journey of Israel might spark up ideas about your own spiritual life, or maybe about the life and the rhythms of the church where you are. Here are some things. Number one, travelers have to trust God. You know, during Israel's travels, they didn't have a whole lot to rely on. When you don't have much, it's not hard to feel how vulnerable you are. We really are all vulnerable, but we try to camouflage it. We add titles, we add jobs, we add houses, we add retirement plans, and then we sort of think we've got stuff and we're okay. Or maybe we build big church buildings and attractive programs and construct a carefully managed church image in the community, and we sort of accumulate all the trappings of settled life and think we're okay. But all that stuff can go away just like that. And some of it, as it happens, doesn't have a whole lot to do with where God's leading us anyway. The vagabond spirituality of the Israelites says, pack less stuff, travel light, but keep your faith handy. Paulinus of Nola wrote a poem in the 430s, and he looks at that scene at the Red Sea where the well-equipped Egyptians are on one side and the Israelites are over here, and all they've got is their faith, and it's pretty flimsy at that. But he sees what happens as a result, and he concludes, "We find that weapons have always needed faith, but faith has never needed weapons." What is it you're relying on? What is it that you're packing with you? What are you spending yourself on spiritually or as a church? If you don't find yourself regularly stepping out beyond what you can manage on your own, it's time to check the road signs and see if you're really going the right way, because the Christian journey is one that's filled with stuff that's too big for you and me to handle. Some of them are opportunities. Some of those things are dangers. But the road that we're on becomes this training ground for learning faith, learning trust. Ephraim was a Syrian writer in the 4th century. And I just looked at a lot of different sermons and poems and different things people were writing, commentaries about Israel's wanderings, and picked up some things that I thought would be interesting to take note of. He says, take note of this. If God doesn't give the rain and the wind, being anxious about it's not going to help you. Obey God and creation will obey your needs. If God nourished Israel for 40 years in the desert while they were murmuring and disbelieving and effortlessly preserved their sandals, how much more so in the case of believers? There's a little bit of, you know, there's a slight undertone of sarcasm there. If God was able to take care of those people with their flimsy faith, surely He'd be able to manage you giants of faith, you know, and your amazing trust in God. So stop worrying about stuff, but again and again, on this journey, recognize that you're going to have to take the forks in the road that require you to rely more on God and less on yourself. Next, travelers learn to prioritize. What's the number one rule for packing before you go on a trip? Pack it all up and then take half of it out. Coming from people that travel a lot. Yeah, that's right. Get rid of half of it. But you need to be careful, right, about what you get rid of. You can't just indiscriminately, you know, throw things out. But the fact is, on this journey, some things are just flat expendable. And some things aren't. You know, Israel learned you could do without a lot of things. And I wonder what it would be like in your church or mine if we learned that we could do without some of these things. That we could do without comfort. We could do without security. We could do without water. I don't know about air conditioning here in Texas, but they didn't need big buildings. They didn't need extravagant programs. Even all the gold and spoils of Egypt that they packed out of Egypt with them turned out to be mostly a problem later on down the road. But some things, the things that are closest to the heart of God, you really need those things. Caesarius of Arles lived in the 500s, and he was preaching a sermon on Exodus 17. And he's where the text says the people thirsted for water. And in his sermon, he basically says, and you have to, you know, read the Greek to see this, but he says, duh. Of course you're thirsting for water. What else would you be thirsting for? Why does the text say they thirsted for water? Well, because really there are a lot of things you could be craving. There are a lot of things you could be thirsting for. One of the reasons for the text specifying it, Caesarius says, is because they were worried about the wrong things, desiring the wrong things. The people thirsted for water, he said, when they should have thirsted for justice. They were short on water, it's true, but they were pretty short on justice too, and one of those things mattered a lot more than the other thing. John Chrysostom is another preacher in the early 400s. He's preaching in Antioch. And he's talking about these passages, and he says, you know, you can really tell when people are too prosperous for their own good. Here's a great example, the Israelites in the wilderness. God is giving them manna, the bread from heaven. It's like the food of the angels. But you look at Numbers 11, and all they can do is gripe about the fact that they're missing the onions from Egypt. You know, you've got manna and you want onions, what's the deal? But there's this kind of confusion of priority that sets in when we have a lot of stuff and we think all the stuff is equally important. A vagabond spirituality, bless you, calls into question all the stuff we try to lug along with us. All the things in our churches, you know, that we overstuff our bags with, non-essentials. An important traveling tip in this spiritual style is to hold most things pretty lightly. If we have them, great. If we don't, okay. I can turn loose of them. It's not a big deal. But hold very tightly onto the big things. And it's not hard to tell from Scripture what the big things are. Things like love God and love neighbor. Travelers need each other. You know, whether it's Moses needing somebody to hold up his hands fighting the Amalekites, or it's delegating out to the elders of the people so that they can rule more wisely, or it's building the tabernacle, setting up the tabernacle, the Israelites throughout their wanderings relied on each other a lot. And I think about my my friend Brendan, who was getting ready to set out on the sea voyage to the Promised Land. And it took a whole band of folks to build the boat that they were going to need. And the life of Brendan goes into all kinds of detail about the building of this great boat that they were setting out in. And all along the voyages on the sea, they help each other. They look out for one another. Because you need to rely on each other. When you're travelers and you don't have stuff and you don't have a place and you're holding on to things lightly, a lot of what you have is one another. And it matters that you're together and you're doing things together and you're helping each other along the way. It also matters that you have people who can do different kinds of things. Origen, writing in the 3rd century in Alexandria in Caesarea, he's interpreting some of these passages. And he says, you know, you need Moses and you need Aaron. You need somebody who's got knowledge and has got great faith, but you also need people who can do the works, the fruit of works, well-pleasing to God. You need both of those kinds of people in order to be a community that can travel through the wilderness together. Vagabond spirituality is marked by diversity. That's, I think, an important principle. Israel was told that they should be generous with other people, that they should be compassionate towards one another and to others, because God had been generous with them. God had been compassionate with them. When they were down, He provided what they needed and took care of them. And Clement of Alexandria, writing in the 3rd century, kind of picks up on this and talks about the ways in which the children of Israel received so much from the Lord, and so do we. He says, by these words, Scripture is showing us clearly that it's God who grants us gifts of good things, and we ought, as servants of the grace of God, to sow God's gracious gifts and enable our neighbors to become people of honor as well. So, vagabond spirituality is not only marked by diversity, vagabond spirituality is marked by generosity. It's that sort of attitude that says, we don't have much, but you're welcome to what we've got. John Chrysostom noticed that a lot of the Israelites, they were given this great gift of manna, but they weren't satisfied just to have the one day's worth, right? So they're kind of accumulating and hoarding it all together. And what happens to the manna when they do that? Yeah, it's all wormy and rotten. He says, you've only got one stomach to fill. If you have more stuff than you need, the aim is not to hoard it. The reason you have more is so that you can share it with other people. If we're going to travel down this road together and get anywhere, we're going to have to take care of one another. And not only share the things we have in terms of sort of, you know, our food and our care of one another, but also to share our stories. Vagabond spirituality is one of storytelling and testimony. It's partly what we're doing here today. You know, Israel kept telling the story over and over again, and it got written down. And the apostles kept telling their stories of touring with Jesus in Galilee and Palestine, and that stuff got written down, and it's been preached over the centuries. The people we're talking about, the Origens and the Chrysostoms and the Caesariuses, are all people who are telling the stories. They've been down the road, and they have some sense of what's down the road. They've met God in those places, and they want to talk about those things. Travelers depend on stories from the road, because sometimes you meet these people that are, you know, a little further along the path. They have a little more wisdom to help out. They know the way. They want to help you along. And other people are just starting, but they're filled with this enthusiasm, this vibrancy about the beginning of the path, the beginning of the journey that they want to share. I think vagabond spirituality is a spirituality in which people are gathered around the campfires, and they're swapping stories about things that they've met on the road, things that they've seen in their lives, ways in which they've encountered God and the wisdom that the Lord has given them. Another big point, and it's really a big one. Travelers learn to appreciate the rhythms and the seasons and the cycles of the journey. A good illustration of this is back with my friend Origen again. in the middle of the 3rd century, he wrote this homily on Numbers 33. And Numbers 33 lays out these 42 stations of Israel's journeys early on, all these 42 places that Israel stopped. And he sees these places as sort of symbols of spiritual experiences that we have. And one of the ways he does that is by sort of unpacking the meaning of the place names. Now, sometimes his etymology is a little wacky, but that's kind of beside the point. The point is that he's seeing the spiritual life as one marked by seasons and different experiences. For example, station one, you leave Ramesses, and Ramesses means a kind of agitated disorder because you're leaving the confusion and the chaos of a worldly way of living into a more orderly path along with the people of God on the journey. And right after Ramesses is Succoth, which means tents, because we have to learn to dwell in tents like a wanderer. Traveling along these stations is a vagabond kind of experience. People in the earlier stages of the spiritual life, they're often real enthusiastic. There's the excitement of the Red Sea, for example, which is a really great triumph station. And then there are places like Eroth, which means villages. And that represents the little triumphs, the little victories that we experience in our lives. But they can also be very unpleasant. Because even early on, right after you've left the slavery of Egypt, those old habits die hard. And learning new ways of being, new ways to treat one another, new ways to see ourselves, new ways to honor God, they can be pretty difficult. There's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of discipline that goes into that. And that's why we have the station of Marah, which is bitter. It's the bitterness of the discipline. But when you practice the disciplines of Christian ways of living, right after Marah comes Elim, the sweet water, that reminds you that it's really all worthwhile as you begin to see the disciplines of your life paying off in the way that you are. Sometimes you feel like you're really making great progress, like when you're at Rafaka, which means health. You feel strong. You can see that God is dealing with the spiritual sicknesses in your life. Or maybe when you're in the desert of Sin. Origen says Sin means either a bramble bush or a temptation. And there's this experience in the spiritual life where you're starting to discern, to learn how to discern better when you're hearing a voice from a bramble bush that's burning, like Moses did, or you're hearing a voice from the temptations of the evil one. Sometimes God feels very close, as on Mount Sinai. But sometimes you're in a place like Buthan, which is a valley, and it's deep and it's dark and it feels very distant from the Lord. Or maybe at Sephar, which means the sound of trumpets and symbolizes the warfare that God's people have to encounter sometimes. The point is, and we won't go through all 42 stations, is that these are all normal journey rhythms, normal vagabond rhythms for Christians and for churches. Some days are days for singing and dancing with Miriam, and some days are days for fighting battles with evil powers and mourning the casualties of that conflict. Sometimes the spiritual life is rich, it's satisfying. Sometimes it's stale and dry and unfulfilling, and God doesn't seem very close at all. Well, for Origen, there's a kind of a logic to those rhythms. Because usually, after the Lord brings you out of a dark place, then the blessing of the peace you experience after that, and the sense of maturity that you have having passed through that, is really equipping you for the next challenge, the next trial. So, you've got a station like Kata'af, which can mean either encouragement or endurance. For it's necessary for someone who wants to be of use to others to suffer many things and to bear them all patiently. Learning to endure makes you an encouragement to others, and enduring encourages you. And when you encourage, you can help other people endure. These experiences are really important experiences for transformation and growth. Perhaps you used to think that the way which God shows would be level and easy, and certainly would involve no difficulty or labor. It is an ascent, and a winding ascent. Gregory of Nyssa talks about Moses in the 4th century, and talks about how when Moses would come to a summit on the journey, that enabled him to see a broader horizon than he was able to see before. And so he, you know, sort of triumphed in the challenge of ascending a summit so that he could see what the next set of challenges were going to be. And that's the nature of the spiritual life. The journey's not supposed to be a vacation. It's not just a way to pass the time. It's a journey of being transformed, of being shaped into the image of Christ, a process of being equipped to bless other people. Here's an interesting thing that I've noticed. You might be able to draw a map, but it's probably going to have to be later. Sometimes you can see where you're going, you kind of know what's happening, but a lot of times, like Israel, you're not even sure where you're at, much less what's going to happen next or where you're going next. Love this story about Jerome, who writes in the 400s. And he used to have Bible studies with a Roman noblewoman named Fabiola, and they're going over Numbers 33. They're going over these 42 stations. When she asked me the meaning and reason of each of these, I spoke doubtfully about some, dealt with others in a tone of assurance, and in several instances simply confessed my ignorance. And the thing is, Fabiola gets really upset with him about this because she wants answers to all the questions. You know, what are all these places? What do they mean in the text? What do they mean for my life? What are these places about? And he's not really sure for some of them. I can relate to this, you know. If you can imagine being somebody who's traveling with a couple of friends by foot, 100 or so miles across northern England, and you're the person who was given the responsibility of being the guide with the book, keeping track of the map, leading the group. And then maybe it's possible that you took a wrong turn at some point and went down this steep, muddy track to the bank of a river and then realized, hey, we've got to climb back up the steep, muddy track. And there's a lot of tumbling and difficulty getting back up to the top. And then when you get there, your traveling friend, you know, might look something like this. Some of you know Doug Foster. I don't know if you've seen that expression on his face before, but you know, at that moment, the fact that I really didn't know where I was going wasn't really that helpful. Sometimes, even the experts just don't know exactly what's happening, what it all means, where you're going to go next. And one of the things that you learn in a kind of journeying spirituality is that a lot of times the best discernment, the best spiritual discernment, comes after the fact. Israel was able to look back and reinterpret experiences that it did not like, to see them in a different way and to understand how God was working in their lives. And you see this in Scripture. You see Jesus doing this. You see this in Acts 15. This is kind of a normal way of doing spiritual discernment, is to reflect on things that have happened and to think about then where God was in all of that. And much of the time, I think that's what we're left to do. In fact, really, you need to be cautious about following anybody who claims to know exactly what God's doing right now and what his next move's going to be, because that's unlikely. So, how do we know where to go? Well, Gregory of Nyssa thought that the key to traveling well on this journey was to do what Moses did and to become God's friend. The Lord used to speak to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. I mean, how did they do that? How did they talk face to face? Because, you know, God's invisible and no one has ever seen God, right? So later on in the chapter, you read that, well, what Moses actually got to see was the back of God, right? Or the hind parts of God in Exodus 33:23. So Gregory says, so Moses, who eagerly seeks to behold God, is now taught how he can behold him, to follow God wherever he might lead, is to behold God. His passing by signifies his leading the one who follows. The passing by, that's mentioned there in the text of Exodus 33. Gregory of Nyssa's tip on this is really fairly straightforward. The secret to traveling well is to keep your eyes focused on God's backside. Just to lock in and follow God. I think that would make like a great marquee for your church, right? You know, come follow God's backside with us or something like that. It needs to be snappier than that. It's got to fit on the marquee. But this is exactly what Gregory's talking about. Wherever God goes, that's where you want to go. That's what Moses did. That's how Moses led the children of Israel. And this is a very different way of seeing God in relation to where we are and what's going on. Rather than seeing God as at some central location and he's sending you out to some place, God is already out there. He's on the move. He's on the way. And you want to go out there and find out where he is. Now, Gregory strongly believed that you could not actually with physical eyes see God. And he had plenty of, you know, biblical support for that. So what is it that Moses is actually seeing? The glory of God. The effects of God's presence. The evidence of his having been there because of the things that were happening and the residue that was left in that place. And he would come down from the mountain with his face shining. Not because he really, with physical eyes, seen God, but the glory emanating from the person of God has left an impression on Moses, and he brings it down, and that leaves an impression on the people. So what you do is you keep looking for the effects of God's presence and the effects of God's activity out in the world, following from place to place, as you see the work of God out there in different places, getting a better eye all the time for spotting what it might look like. Well, sometimes you just don't know where you're headed. You may not even know where you are. That's not a very comfortable place to be, but it's really okay because journeys are like that. It does take trust. It does take patience. And you may not always know what's around the next bend, but you do know some things. You know what kind of a God it is that you're following. And because of that, you know what it would look like to spot places where he's at work. And you know who you're supposed to be, wherever you happen to be. And meanwhile, you just keep looking for the effects of his activity along the way. Because in these wandering narratives, and in the ways early Christians sort of read that and thought about that, maybe most days the journey is actually the point. You know, Jesus calls his disciples to come and follow him. And in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and in chapters 29, we read about how the children of Israel are being formed into a certain kind of people because of their traveling. They're given a mind that understands, eyes that see, ears that hear, or at least ideally that's what was supposed to happen. The 40 years of wandering wasn't just a punishment. It was meant to be an experience of spiritual formation, a chance to train and shape them in particular ways. And it's an ongoing experience. Gregory admits, you follow Moses, you realize you can never really get to it all. God is infinite. You can't go all the places God goes. You can't be all the things God is. You can't cover all the territory that God covers. And yet Jesus calls us to be perfect in Matthew 5. And Paul is straining towards something in Philippians chapter 3. And Gregory ponders all of that and decides that we've sort of misconstrued the idea of perfection. That perfection isn't this static thing that you possess. It's not a point on a number line. It's a process. It's a process of growth, a process of journeying with vagabond spirituality, where your spiritual life is being defined in terms of journey with the Lord. Growth happens along the way in the process of becoming like Jesus. Eternal life happens along the way as you seek out and join the Lord at work in the world. The perfection of human nature consists perhaps in its very growth in goodness, Gregory says, studying the life of Moses. And that's pretty challenging, because it means this thing is dynamic, this thing is moving, increasing measure, on the move. It's a race to run. So you can never really kind of kick back and rest on your laurels and say, well, I have the possession I need, I have salvation, or we've built the church we need and now it's done. There's always more ground to cover. There are new frontiers to cross. There are new vistas to experience. But on the other hand, as challenging as that is, because it basically means if you're complacent, it wants to kick you out of your complacency. Whether we're talking about complacency in terms of our spiritual lives or our church's mission. As challenging as that is, it's also encouraging to think about journeying spirituality. Because it means that if we're on the journey, then we're where we're supposed to be. Because you're supposed to be on the journey. And different people in different groups are going to be at different places on the journey, and there is no way to, you know, constrain Scripture, much less the Christian experience, into a single, unified journey, like there's only one journey precisely. It's more this principle of moving with God and towards God is the point. Well, we could say a lot more about the journey. I just wanted to give you a glimpse of some of the ways that Christian writers got inspired by this vagabond spirituality. And maybe some of those images will spark your own imagination so that you can go back to these stories in Exodus and in Numbers and in Deuteronomy and look for pictures that might help you make sense of your life or help you make sense of wherever it is that the life of your congregation is at. As I sum up, I want to keep pushing that. I want you to think about how these lessons from the road might shape what you expect from your church. God's people are born to travel. So being on the move from place to place, a bit unsettled and dislocated, uncomfortable as it is, it's right. Salvation and life happen along the way. In baptism, we're embarking on a journey. More than just gaining a possession or acquiring a state, it's the embarkation of a journey. Travelers have to trust God. Travelers learn to prioritize. There's some things you need, some things you don't need. It's good to be clear on what those things are. Travelers need each other. For instance, vagabond spirituality is marked by diversity within the traveling community. It's marked by generosity as people take the gifts that they've been given and the resources that they have and share them with those who need them. And it's one of storytelling and testimony as stories from the road keep coming up around the campfire. Travelers learn to appreciate the rhythms and the cycles of the spiritual life in a journey with the Lord. And maybe, therefore, some of those that have been down that path a little longer than some of the rest of us might be really good storytellers about this, who can help us weather storms along the way, whether they're personal storms or the challenges that come up in our churches. You might be able to draw a map, but that's likely to come later. What you need to do is just keep your eye focused on God's backside and go wherever He is to get up to whatever He's been doing. Finally, the journey itself is sort of the point. Thanks very much for your attention. Tomorrow, we're just going to talk about the wilderness and dwell there for a while. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.